May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Jim Dietrich, attorney number 7422. I represent the appellant, National Farmers Union Property and Casualty Company, which I'll refer to as NFU during argument. As the court knows, this is an insurance coverage issue involving a policy of homeowners insurance issued by NFU to Larry Gerbaz, under which his wife Molly Gerbaz also qualified as an insured. Also implicated factually in this case is the fact that NFU also issued a farm policy to adjacent property, property adjacent to the homeowners insured property, and the farm policy was issued to an LLC known as 100 Road Cattle Company, which was essentially a closely held LLC by the Gerbaz family. And obviously I will focus on the legal arguments, but factual background is really necessary to dovetail into the legal arguments if it pleases the court. What happened was the Gerbazes, Larry and Molly Gerbaz, lived on a residential property in the Roaring Fork Valley outside of Carbondale. There was development coming up the valley. The Gerbazes decided that they wanted to acquire the adjacent ranch property. They met with their lawyer. They set up an LLC in order to acquire the adjacent ranch property. Molly Gerbaz, who's an insured under the homeowner policy, put in $270,000 to purchase one third membership in the LLC. $270,000 from her personally. Another $270,000 was contributed by a trust which had been set up in favor of Molly Gerbaz and her children. And then the other one third ownership in the LLC was funded by trusts set up for Molly Gerbaz's children. So the LLC was essentially a family LLC, which was set up for the sole purpose of purchasing, owning, and operating the property which was adjacent to the property on which Molly and Larry Gerbaz resided and which was insured by the homeowner's policy. The operations on the ranch were fairly minimal, but there were leasing activities and renting activities which took place. This was in 1999 when the ranch property was purchased by the Gerbaz Family LLC. So,
Mr. Dietrich, how many acres is the ranch?
Your Honor, I was looking in the record for that, and I did not find a specific recitation to that in the record. It's a number of acres. It's not just 1 or 2 acres. It's a substantial piece of property. And on the property, there's a ranch house and various outbuildings and a pasture. So I would be guessing if I put a number out there, but it's a number of acres. It's a rural setting in the Roaring Fork Valley just outside of Carbondale. So what happened was in April of 2008, Larry Gerbaz was on the ranch property and he was cleaning up for the purpose of a cattle grazing operation which was going to take place and had taken place at least periodically in the past by a family known as the Nislanics. He was cleaning the property, gathering stumps and wood out of the pasture area. He had piled them up. He built a fire, and it was alleged that fire spread from the ranch property to other property further down valley and caused damage and personal injury. And then two lawsuits were brought. And the lawsuits were brought against the LLC on whose property the activity took place, alleging that Larry Gerbaz was acting on behalf of the LLC at the time that he was cleaning and burning the wood. Larry Gerbaz himself was also personally sued. The lawsuit was settled by the payment of the $1 million policy limits of the LLC farm policy. NFU insured the farm, and the LLC was the named insured under the farm policy. And if you also insured the Gerbazes personally under the homeowner's policy. So the $1 million policy limits under the farm policy were expended to achieve a settlement of the claims against the insureds. But a separate agreement was entered, which brings us here today, which was, does the homeowner's liability policy also, is it also implicated? There are two exclusions in the homeowner's policy which we contend exclude coverage for the claims brought in the lawsuits below, which were settled.
Mr. Dietrich, before you get into those exclusions, just to help me understand how this homeowner's policy is even implicated to begin with, do I understand correctly that if I'm burning brush on my property and it starts a wildfire, my homeowner's policy is implicated? What if I'm burning brush on my neighbor's property, not for a business or anything? I guess I'm having a hard time.
Sure. Your homeowner's policy would likely still be implicated unless there was a business purpose being pursued as a result of that activity. But your homeowner's policy, if you were on your next door neighbor's property helping him clean brush and you were just helping and volunteering, and yes, that your homeowner's policy would get involved. In this case, it's our position on behalf of NFU that there are two exclusions in the homeowner's policy which apply and which should prevent it from being involved. One is the business pursuits exclusion. The other is the owned but not insured exclusion. I'll discuss the business pursuits exclusion first. The business pursuits exclusion provides that the policy does not apply, just to read it, to personal injury or property damage arising out of or in connection with a business engaged in by an insured. Now, the activity was taking place on the LLC property. The LLC, almost by definition, is a business. The operating agreement of the LLC describes its principal place of business. It describes that the business of the company shall be to accomplish any lawful business whatsoever. It provides management of the LLC. It says the business and affairs of the company shall be managed by its managers. The manager is the family lawyer of the Gerbaugh's family, Tom Polacek. He's the one who put the LLC together and made it so that the LLC would actually own this adjacent property. So,
Mr. Dietrich, let me just follow up on your initial comment on this part of your argument. Is the fact that the ranch is in the form of an LLC by itself enough to establish that it's a business?
I think that there's a strong inference that it's a business by that reason. I mean, if it's an LLC, it's either a business or it's a charitable organization, as I understand it. This is not a charitable organization. It's set up under the statutes of Colorado as a business, and it filed business tax returns. The tax returns are part of the record. The tax returns which were filed by the LLC reflected both income and expenses, and they are part of the record. Page 344, among the income that they show are the rents received from the pasturing activities for the year 2008 that Mr. Gerbaugh was preparing the property for at the time the wildfire was allegedly begun. It also includes all these expenses, cleaning and maintenance, insurance, depreciation, things that would only be expensed if it's a business. So it's clearly operating as a business, it's presenting itself as a business, and it's conducting business activities. And the two business activities identified in the record are the at least periodic leasing of pasture land, for which they were paid $1,200 during the year 2008, and that was the actual leasing operation that Mr. Gerbaugh was preparing the property for. And then up until 2008, for the years 1999 through 2007, a cousin of Mr. Gerbaugh's was living on the property, and he was paying some $27,000 a year in rent.
Had you argued that that was the basis of a business, for the LLC? Did you argue that in the district court?
It's before the it's in the briefing before the trial court in the summary judgment reply brief. I know that it was argued by Appley here that that wasn't raised before the trial court, but it was, and there's specific citation to it in my reply brief pointing out and quoting from the record where that $27,000 rent payment was cited to the trial court as part of the activities of the LLC.
Are you aware of any court that has ever recognized, sort of following up on Judge Tomlin's question, that has ever held that the mere fact that something is an LLC without more makes it a business for purposes of the business pursuits exception?
No, I don't have any citation to support that standing by itself. However, the activity that was being done at the time, and the specific activity that was being done at the time of preparing this property for pasturing, was an income-generating activity. Defendants, appellees, argue that it didn't generate enough money to cover the entire cost of the operation, and that's true, but that's not necessary. There are cases, there's the Rodriguez case, Colorado Court of Appeals case, where a home daycare operation was found to be a business activity for the purposes of the exclusion. There was no requirement or necessity in that case stated that the operator of the home daycare had to show that there was enough income from the daycare to cover all the costs of the home. So the fact that the leasing activity did not cover all of the expenses of the LLC, I think is irrelevant.
What about the fact that the leasing activity was sporadic or intermittent? I take it from 2004 to 2007, no rent at all had been received for that activity.
And that's what the records show, Your Honor. And sporadic, to me, I would suggest, I mean, if somebody said, you know, I'll give you $20 if you give me a ride down to the gas station to get a can of gas, or if somebody asked for some one-time thing, that might be sporadic or intermittent. But this was an activity that went on over the course of a year, both 2000.
I'm sorry, it went on over the course of a year, but over the course of 8 years, they only collected rent twice?
Well, we know that they collected rent in 2000, and we know that they collected rent again in 2008 and then in 2009. And we do know that the records show no rent being collected from 04 to 07. And the record's silent as to why that occurred.
Mr. Dietrich, does the record indicate at all what the market value rent would be for use of the ranch property for pasturing and haying?
No, there's no indication independent of the what the parties agreed to, which was obviously $1,200 for the year 2008, and that was $1,000 for the year 2000.
Okay, thank you.
Nothing separate. Now, I'm running short, so I'm going to jump to the next exclusion, which is the owned but not insured exclusion. And I think this involves as much a common sense analysis as anything. Obviously, an insurance company only bargains and collects premiums and evaluates risk for the purpose of a particular insured property in a case such as this, where we're talking about a homeowner's policy. It is not proper for the insurance company to assume a risk of property upon which it did not bargain or collect a premium. So there is what is known as the owned but not insured exclusion, which if you own a piece of property and you insure it, you own another piece of property, but you do not insure it with that insurance company, then activities arising out of that property are not going to be covered by the insurance. And we're
do I understand correctly that the title owner of a property isn't necessarily the named insured? I'm thinking of Molly and Larry Gerbaz's property, which was owned, as I recall, by a trust for the benefit.
That's true. Even their property. This family has things set up in trusts and LLCs, and that's the way. Even their own property insured by the homeowner's policy was not in their name. So the property next door to them also was not in their name. It was in the name of the family LLC set up by the family lawyer and managed by the family lawyer. There is a Colorado case dealing with auto insurance that's very close factually to this in terms of concept, and that's the Martinez case, where a similar exclusion was applied to deny coverage to an individual who was riding a motorcycle, and there was an owned but not insured provision, exclusion in the policy. He didn't have title of the motorcycle. His girlfriend did. It turned out she had title because he didn't want the motorcycle to be part of the divorce settlement. The court said, this is your motorcycle. You don't get coverage. It doesn't matter whose title it's in. And I'm out of time as much as I'd like to keep talking. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. We appreciate your argument.
May it please the court, good afternoon. I'm John Purvis, and I'm the designated spokesperson for the appellees here this afternoon. Sandra Karp, who represents Mr. Garfinkel, is also present, as is Brad Breslau, who represents the remaining appellees. I represent the Ranch at Roaring Fork Homeowners Association, which is a major homeowners association involving several hundred ownership interests in the Roaring Fork Valley. Let me just respond briefly to a couple of things that Mr. Dietrich said and some questions of the court before I get into what we really think is the principal focus or should be here. First of all, factually, when this property was acquired, that is the 100, the County Road 100 property, the so-called farm or ranch property, it was acquired not for business purposes, but as a buffer. Basically, as a sort of open space preservation move to protect against development encroaching on the residence property of the Gerbazes. That would be point one. Point two is that under the business exclusion, business pursuits exclusion, call it what you will, there is, as Judge Daly suggests, a requirement that there be a regularity and continuity of activity and that there be a profit motive. And it's our contention that the record in this case shows that there was not a continuity or regularity of this leasing activity for the reasons that Judge Daly mentioned. Neither was there a profit motive. The motive here was not to make money off this farm. The motive was to use it as a buffer or as an open space preservation.
We talked for a minute about the continuity and regularity of this activity. As I recall, the original lease was an 11-month lease. Is that correct? And if I remember Colorado law, you can renew if a tenant stays on after the expiration of such a written lease with the landlord's consent. Doesn't that result in periodic tenancy or tenancy by years or whatever you call it? In other words, there is still in existence a landlord-tenant relationship even without the written lease.
I suppose, Judge Rose, that could happen. That wasn't addressed in either in the trial court by either side, really. Suppose it could happen. In this circumstance, factually, however, it did not happen because apparently there was no continuation of the activity of making this property available to the Miss Lennox.
Don't we have testimony by Mr. Gerbaz that the lease had been started by his cousin and still continued, and also by the attorney that it was simply rolled over from year to year?
But what Mr. Palchik, Mr. Gerbaz says, he didn't really know anything about this lease. And what Mr. Palchik said, the business manager, was, I presume that it rolled over. Why do you say that? Was the question. Next question. And he said, because I have no direct knowledge. So he really didn't know what had happened to that lease, except that it had been signed off in 2000 and then expired. But let me go beyond those points at this point to what we see as being the central focus here, and that is the meaning of these two exclusions which are at issue. We have a homeowner's policy, which is in effect, and it provides insurance, homeowner's insurance, and that's general liability insurance, usually, and in this case, whether it happens on your homeowner's premises or your negligence occurs elsewhere. The named insured on that policy was Larry Gerbaz. His spouse is also covered as an insured, being a member of his household. So those are the two insureds under that policy. The fact is that what the business pursuits exclusion requires and provides is that the coverage will be excluded if it's something, if it arises out of business activity or connected with business activity of the insured. So what we're talking about here is not the business of the LLC, if it was a business, but instead, was there a business of the insureds, either of them, which constituted a basis for invoking this exclusion and essentially extinguishing the coverage which would otherwise exist. In this case, Judge Stern, I would submit, did a superb job of analysis and resolution of this case, and his order is really a template for that process, although obviously this court is looking at this de novo. But as a template, it provides a very useful tool. It's comprehensive, it's conscientious, it's clear, and it's concise. And most of all, it separates the wheat from the chaff in this case. The wheat really is the meaning and effect of these two exclusions, not some of these other things that I'll discuss in a minute that have been introduced into the record and into argument. So we have the one exclusion, provides for exclusion if it's arising out of or in connection with a business pursuit of an insurer. Then we have the second, which is the only property exclusion, and that also is a limited and precise language, and all the words in these exclusions count.
Mr. Purvis, if I might ask you about the business exclusion, do you think that the rental income in and of itself, or the rental income together with the fact that this was for an LLC, is enough to show that there was a business?
Our answer would be no, Your Honor, and I think Judge Stern felt the same way, that because of the irregularity of it and the absence of a profit motive in terms of the business of the LLC, there would not be the sufficient basis for a business exclusion under the language from Couch, which we cite in our brief and which is referenced in the other briefing. But again, I come back to what we think is a key point, that whether that's true or not, whether the LLC was involved in a business or not, the fact of the matter is the business of the LLC is not the business of the insureds, Molly or Gerbaz or Larry Gerbaz, unless you ignore all of the established distinctions that exist in the law between a corporation and its shareholders, or an LLC and its members, which is the same thing. I mean, for example, if a member of this court were to own stock, let's say be a shareholder in General Motors, that does not mean that that particular jurist is engaged in the business of manufacturing automobiles. There's a whole different set of parameters in terms of who's in that business. That's General Motors. It's not the shareholders. Just as here, it's the LLC that was involved in the business, which has the business, which Judge Stern says there was no business. I mean, and not that of the insurers. With respect to the insurers, it's important to point out that Larry Gerbaz, and this is in the briefing, was a retired UPS delivery man. He retired, he was sitting around the house. He never had a business of any kind that he testified to. He was never paid by the LLC for any of the work that he did. He never expected to get paid. He never did anything until the spring of 2008. And then finally he did some stuff because, as he testified, when you worked all your life, it's hard to just sit around and do nothing. And number two, it was a property where work needed to be done, and so he did it. But it doesn't make him an employee or that the business of the LLC. Or he may have been acting on behalf of the LLC, as we allege in the other lawsuit, but that doesn't mean that the business exclusion here is triggered, because the business was not that of the insurance, Molly and Larry Gerbaz. Now, the same principles really apply to the issue of ownership. Was the property owned by the insurance? It had to be owned by either Larry or Molly Gerbaz.
Well, let me ask you about that, because they've cited a case that says in the insurance context, ownership isn't necessarily the same as the name of the person in which it's titled. And the second thing is, apparently in this record, there's a lot of activity for which Molly is engaged in on this property. So why isn't the combination of those two circumstances supportive of an application of the ownership but not insured property exclusion?
Well, for a couple of three reasons, Your Honor, we believe. Number one, the cases that are relied upon, Mr. Dietrich referred, I think, to the Martinez case, in terms of that ownership, title not necessarily being necessary for ownership, deal with automobiles. And there's a statute which says, and there's case law which says, that title to an automobile is presumptive indicia of ownership, but is not conclusive. And what each of those cases does is look at the factual circumstances and say, under these circumstances, Martinez is one of them, every indicia and activity necessary to transfer of the car and to ownership except transfer of title occurred. And so for purposes of the automobile insurance statute, under the automobile title statute, that doesn't qualify as that's enough for ownership for the insurance to apply. In this circumstance, there was absolutely never any transfer of any ownership interest from the LLC to any of its members. And a very telling point in that connection is that in their opening brief, the NFU points out that the out of blacks, that ownership involves the whole bundle of sticks, as we all learned in law school, a phrase that I didn't expect to be using too much in my later years, involves a whole bundle of sticks, and including, most especially, the right to transfer and sell the property, to sell it to others. The sine qua non, really, of ownership. In this case, it's absolutely clear. There's no dispute about the fact. Molly Gerbaz had zip authority to do any such thing, to transfer the ownership. That authority rested with the manager of the LLC under the LLC operating agreement and needed to be approved by two-thirds of the members in the LLC. So there never was, in this circumstance, any indication that the property was... the ownership had all things that occurred except for some formality, as was the case in these auto cases. The other thing about the ownership thing is that, again, if it's ownership by the LLC, there's no question about that. I mean, that's what it's titled in, that there was any transfer. That doesn't equate to or convert to ownership by the members of the LLC or the shareholders, if we were talking about a regular corporation. Just as an example I gave before about General Motors, if the jurist that we were talking about there were a shareholder in General Motors, does that make that jurist mean that jurist owns or owned the downtown Detroit headquarters of General Motors? Nope. There's an entirely different set of facts and parameters where there's corporate ownership. And the reasons are multiple in terms of the corporate law, in terms of individual liability protections, and a whole plethora of other things. But in this circumstance, the only way you can get to a business activity or to a property owned by the non-insured owned premises situation is if you say Molly Gerbaz owned it. Well, the only way you can get there is either by following that line of cases with the auto thing, which is a very special thing, or by saying that there is no distinction between a shareholder or a member and a corporation or an LLC. That's the only way you can get there, and that's just not what the law is in Colorado. Also, with respect to this issue of owned, we've talked in the brief, and the court's well familiar with the governing principles in terms of exclusions. It has to be clearly expressed. To be effective, it has to be clearly expressed in the policy. That the policy is to be read according to its plain language and its meaning that would be attributed by an ordinary reader. So indicative of that is the fact, in this case, is the fact that when Mr. Gerbaz, Mrs. Gerbaz, and Tom Polachek were asked who owned the 100 County Road 100 property, all of them said the LLC owned it. that's indicative of what the meaning of the word owned is in the context of the insurance situation and the law, which says the words of a policy should be given their ordinary meaning, according to what would be interpreted by the ordinary reader, should be given their plain and usual meaning. Not some specialized meaning of ownership that derives out of the automobile registration statutes or anything else, but just the meaning that would be given to it by a lay person. And it's pretty clear that from the people involved with this, that those lay people said it was meant owned, and owned meant by the LLC. So, for those reasons, basically, because of the principles that we've cited in terms of what's governing the application of an exclusion, another important one being that they are to be construed in favor of the insured and in favor of the broadest possible coverage. And if the insurer wants to exclude, they have to do so clearly.
Mr. Purvis, your time is up.
Caught up with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Purvis. Thank you again, Mr. Dietrich. We appreciate both of your fine arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.